Thank you, Simon. My name is Adam Finkelstein, and I'm from Teaching and Learning Services at McGill University here in Montreal. Welcome to Montreal for those who've never been here before. We enjoy our city, and I'm glad to have you here to take part as well. And I'm glad to have followed Simon because in some ways we're going to take a few steps backwards and sort of think about some of the underlying themes that he alluded to in terms of really designing learning environments, taking into account some of the learners that we have, the types of learners that we have. And you notice I've got a couple of cartoons at the bottom, about the, we could read your blog, but could you just tell us about your school day? And some things about what's changing with our students that we have in our curriculum today. So, just have a quick look at this quote here. Today, preschoolers acquainted with cell phones, pagers, and personal computers go to kindergartens where chalkboards and overhead projectors represent the state of the art. Now, before we go too much farther, I just want to get an idea. How many people here are what I guess you'd call classroom educators? Okay. How many people would consider some like clinical educators? Okay. How many of you are just researchers and have never gone or done much teaching at all? Okay. And the rest of you were therapists or just different areas? Okay. All right, so that's good. That gives me an idea here. What I want to do is address three major questions in 20 minutes. First is, who are our learners? Second is, what do we know about good teaching and learning? And so what are some of the issues that have come up in the last 30 years, and how can we really capitalize on really what the research has told us is good about teaching and learning? And the last part is, well, how can we use that to design effective learning, which is really what a lot of us, especially in higher education, are really all about. And the nice thing about these, a lot of these principles, is you can apply them in a lot of different types of situations. One-on-one teaching, you know, group teaching, traditional methods, traditional situations, or virtual worlds. So first, I just want to do a quick summary of generations. And generations is a bit of a construct. A lot of the ideas that comes from some of the concept of generations is really North American centric. So if you're from outside North America and this really doesn't make sense to you, I apologize. But I just wanted to get a quick idea. How many people in the room would say they're baby boomers? Okay. How many people would say they're the silent traditionalist era? How many people are Gen X? Okay. And anybody are millennials in the group? Okay. All right. So we have a pretty good spread. A lot of Gen X, which is sort of where I've plopped myself as well. And there are some really interesting implications about what's different in each generation as it moves forward. And what I really want to focus on is the millennials, because if you think about the millennials as a group, here in 2008, the students that are entering university right now were born in 1990. Now, I don't know about you, but 1990 to me seems like yesterday. Doesn't really seem like it was that long ago. So it's something to keep in mind. And what types of students are we really going to have on our campus environments, or part of our e-learning environments, or part of our therapies that we're dealing with if we're dealing with children or even young adults today? So the millennials are children of the late boomers and early Gen Xers. They're the largest generation since the baby boomers. So if you look at baby boomers, around 80 million. The Gen X was a real shrinking in population, about 60 million, and we're already at 85 with millennials and rising in terms of how many exist on the planet. So they really are going to take over in terms of the biggest generation of people today. Major world events for millennials are the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of Cold War. They never grew up with the idea that there was this Russia-US tension in the world. The threat of thermonuclear war has sort of faded out of memory. They dealt with Iraq, part one and part two, Columbine, 9/11, terrorism, all sorts of different things that have shaped their upbringing from the late 80s and through the 90s. They are the most racially and ethnically diverse generation to date. They have incredible purchasing power, more so than any other generation before. I think the numbers that they're talking about is the average millennial student spending about $160 on communication per month, cell phone, internet, etc. Just to give you an idea. Millions and billions and billions of dollars worth of purchasing power. And they're digital natives. To them, these icons are passé. We've been doing this since I was three. I had my Facebook page before I was born. You know? Second Life, oh yeah, I've seen that, I've been doing that for a little while, it's kind of fun too. But when you look at really the impact that these type of sites have on our society, Facebook it's interesting about Facebook, although it really started in the millennials, a lot of the Gen Xers jump on Facebook, and now a lot of the millennials think Facebook is sort of like, you know, that's where a lot of the old people are going now. So it's something to keep in mind as we move forward. And of course, that just is a drop in the bucket compared to the thousands of other Web 2.0 type of websites that are out there with Wikipedia and Dig and FeedBurner and all these other ones that allow you to do collaboration and active learning and all sorts of interesting things online. So really millennials comes from, or the term millennials comes from Strauss and Howe in this book, Millennials Rising. And they also wrote Generations and the 13th Gen, which is what they call Gen X. And there are a couple of key characteristics of millennials that are important for the discussion about thinking about teaching and learning. They're special. Their parents have been telling them they were special since day one. They have the baby on board signs. The baby boom generation has done everything in their power to create a really, really safe environment for them. They've waited to have kids. They were financially stable. They've created this very, 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 very important and helpful environment for them and made them feel special, that the world is their oyster and they could just go out and do anything, right? They're sheltered. They're very sheltered. They're not really sure when you get to the real world, what the concepts that they have in their heads are not exactly what's going on when they step out into the working world. They're confident, sometimes overly so. They're the type of generation that will walk into the CEO's office and say, well, been here for a year, it's time for my promotion. You know, I mean, I expect to have moved on after 2 years of my first job, and, you know, when am I going to be CEO? They're confident. They have that confidence within them. They're team-oriented. They've been working in teams and groups since they were two, in kindergarten all the way on up, and the idea of team-based learning has invaded into K-12 education and into university. They're used to working in groups. They're used to working with each other. They collaborate and form groups on their own outside of class and in formal spaces. They tend to be conventional, and this is interesting, in that they tend to follow their parents' values. They communicate with their parents often. Sometimes they say on average right now 1.5 times a day that millennials are communicating with their parents. They're very close with their parents in the way that their parents are thinking. They're very, very high achieving. And actually, a lot of the surveys have done, you know, I think something like 80% of them expect to be president of the United States. They all expect to be famous. They all expect to have a really good income. They're all above average. Everyone's above average, right? And the last one is pressured. There's a huge amount of pressure put on that generation. From birth, they're meant to be thinking about their SAT scores, where they're going to go to college. Everything's been hammered into them from day one. Be careful if you're jumping around too much. We've got to get you on drugs, get you back on track. And with that, I want to give you just a second to look at this cartoon. I'll read it for you, sorry. Hobbes says, you're working on your report already, it's not due till next Thursday. And Calvin says, yeah, I know, Mom says the pills I'm taking are starting to work. I thought we could go outside and play, it's snowing. Calvin, no answer. What? Oh, sorry, I wasn't listening, really, I have to finish this. And Hobbes turns back into a stuffed animal. Now, when I first show this type of, usually you look, oh, cartoon, it's going to be funny. And this is one of those cartoons that just hits you right in the stomach. And there's a lot of things in there. There's a whole bunch of ideas in there that could be talked about for hours. But I think one of the key things is this pressure that a lot of the millennials are feeling about high achievement, about really being able to make sure you focus. You don't have 5 minutes in between running from school to running to soccer, and after soccer you have to go to your after homework practice, after that you have to have dinner, and everything is scheduled. Everything is back to back. So the next question then is, well, what do we know about good teaching and learning? And with that, what I want to do is take 20 seconds, and I want you to think about this question. I learn best when blank. What I want you to do is turn to the person next to you for literally 20 seconds and just answer the question right now. Go ahead. Turn to the person next to you and fill in the last part of the phrase. Okay. So what did you say? Give me some words. I learn best when... When I can do it with my head? I learn best when... With my hands. When I do it with my hands. Great. I learn best when...
When I'm showing off.
When I'm showing off. I learn best when...
I'm happy.
When I'm happy.
When I'm involved.
When I'm
playing.
When I'm playing.
When I'm
fit and healthy.
Alert.
When I'm alert.
Interested and interactive.
When I'm interested and interactive. Anything else? Great, I don't have to finish this.
When I feel.
Sorry, what was that?
When I feel.
When you feel. Great. So, some interesting things came up. If you notice, not one of you said, I learn best when I sit in the lecture hall with 500 other students and spend my 8:30 in the morning for an hour and a half listening to somebody talk. Interesting, eh? Okay, so what I want to do is talk about briefly about a shift that's been happening, and a paradigm shift that's been happening in educational research and educational teaching and learning research, moving from content-centered thinking or content-centered approaches to learning-centered approaches, and what sort of impact this has on the way that we think about teaching with our students. The first thing is the focus. The content-centered approaches tend to focus on, what do I want to teach? What is the content I want to cover? How am I going to cover that content? It's the old idea that, just wait a minute, I got three more slides. Hold on a second. As if I get through those three slides and you've learned them magically, my job's done. Whereas on the other side, the learning-centered side, what do I want my students to learn? How can I help them reach those goals? It's not about me delivering content to them, it's about me helping them reach their own, not only their goals, but goals that I've set out for the course or for the particular instructional episode that I have. Teachers usually have to shift from transferring knowledge to students, that I am this wonderful, fantastic center of the universe, and I am going to tell you all the wonderful things you don't know. Lox tabula rasa, you are a blank slate, you bring in nothing, and I just inscribe all these wonderful pieces of knowledge on you. No, everybody's shaking their head. The reality in the learning-centered approach, or in the learning-centered approaches, teachers really have to think of themselves as facilitators. I am helping you on a journey. I am guiding you. I am facilitating the process. That's a very hard thing to do, and that's a lot of reaction that you get with some of the things in universities about teachers not wanting to shift from one to the other. But teachers aren't the only ones who don't want to shift from one mode to the other. Students in content-centered approaches receive information. They sit in the back, I just want to listen. I'm listening. I write down, I surf Facebook, listen a little bit more. Might go back to checking my email, listen a little bit more. As opposed to in learning-centered approaches where it's really about getting people actively engaged, getting them involved, giving them a stake and ownership in the process, getting their brains active and moving. Teaching strategies in content-centered tend to be primary lecture delivery or content presentation. Reading a book, watching a video, getting a lecture of some sort where there's information that I have to glean out of it. Not to say that that's bad, it's just that that's one sort of approach or one side of the approach. Generally, in learner-centered approaches, it's about practice and feedback, it's about collaboration, team learning, it's about working with each other, it's about doing problems, as Simon was talking about, not necessarily listening to somebody talk. Evaluations in content-centered primarily are at the end, grades or final exam. Whereas evaluation in learner-centered is about guiding you, about giving you feedback as you move through the process. Okay, well, so what? That's wonderful. We have these two things here, we have these two different types of approaches. What the research has shown us is that the instructional approach, or the instructional approach that the instructor takes, when you shift from content-centered approach to learning-centered approaches, has some real impacts on what the students are doing in their learning. Content-centered instructional approaches, where teachers present knowledge and students receive knowledge, really are surfaced, it results in surface learning. Learner-centered approaches, where teachers organize activities and students are working on projects and students are actively participating, results in deep learning. So really what you've got here on the one side is students reproducing what teachers present when you're using content-centered approaches, and students finding personal relevance, reflecting and acting upon the ideas in deep learning. Now I bet you probably the only thing you remember from what I'm talking about is when you talk to your friend. You talk to the person next to you. And one of the nice things about that is that you were involved, you were engaged, you had a stake in what was going on. You weren't just sitting there passively listening to what I had to say, even if it was wonderful and brilliant. Students moving from passive to active. And this is one of the things you want to keep in mind as we move forward. And really the idea is if we want to foster deep learning, if we want students to change their entire worldview and thinking process and critically think, then we've got to be looking at deep learning strategies. We've got to be looking at deep learning and learner-centered approaches to be able to do that. So, how do we design for effective learning? One of the nice ways of looking at designing learning is if we plot learning in the center, because really that's what we're worried about. We want to know not about the teaching, we want to know about the learning. Is there learning going on? We have four major areas of design. Whenever you think about designing some sort of episode that you're doing with your students or doing with your, if you're coaching or anything along those lines, first is your content. What is the subject matter? What is the material that you have to deal with? Second is the outcomes. What do you want your students to learn at the end of the day? At the end of the day, what's the point? What do you want your students to gain out of it? The third part, what activities are you doing to support that learning? So you want your students to critically think, but then you just lecture at them for an hour. Something's not quite right there. Assessment. How are you going to know that they learned what you wanted them to learn in the first place? So the nice thing about the circle is that it always goes around in circles, just like everything. And as you change or modify different parts of your courses, different parts of your instruction, everything else changes and modifies along with it. In addition, there's something here called context. You might be, let's say, teaching a large class of 500 people. Suddenly, your wonderful idea about doing small group discussions with 500 people won't work anymore. What am I going to do? How am I going to get over that? I want to do essays, but I can't do that with 500 people. How am I going to get around that? How can I get people to think critically in a large group? Or my context might change. I'm teaching in Second Life. Okay, I'm teaching in Second Life. Well, what's going to be different about the strategies I'm going to be using? Am I going to lecture in Second Life? Maybe not. I have to rethink how I'm going to do that because my context has changed. And one thing you don't see, remarkably, on this graph is anything about technology. Technology is the means to the end. It's not the means or the end. It's not the end unto itself. So in other words, if I decide to use technology, I should be using technology because I've reasoned within my own mind that this is what I want to do and this is why I want to do it. So if I want to use Second Life, as Simon was saying, there should be a reason for me to do it. That reason might be I want to experiment, but that's okay. At least you've brought that reason forward, and you can be clear with your students, this is an experiment. We're trying this out. At the same time, if your whole idea of going into Second Life is you want to change and enhance the learning of your students, you better be really, really careful and really sure that that's what you're setting out to do. Now, with that, there's also something else that's very interesting about the process of learning. As you go through any sort of learning process, and you've all been students at one time or another, so you can think about this, usually at any point in the learning process, there's some sort of gaining attention. You've got to get involved in some way or the other. The cartoon at the beginning that I held up, maybe some off-the-hand comment that you heard that brings you forward, brings you into the activity we're about to do. The second part is informing. There's usually some sort of information. Maybe it's a short little snippet about ideas that somebody has or a video you're going to watch or anything like that. Then there's usually some type of practice and feedback. You have to go work on an assignment with a study group. I want you to do a group activity together. I want you to turn to your neighbor and talk about something. There's some sort of practice with the ideas that I've just talked about within a learning episode. And then, of course, usually at the very end, there's some sort of judgment. How did it all go? How did everything turn out in the end? And what's very interesting is that in most environments, in most classes, in higher education, we do everything in black and we forget the middle. So I engage you and I tell you everything you need to know and then see you later. I'll see you at the exam. You know, good luck on your studying. Right? We never lecture to a group of kindergartners. How can we lecture to a group of 18-year-olds and expect them to react in a different way? The other important thing to think about learning is where is the learning happening, okay? In class, at the very tip of your iceberg, usually it's about 1 hour of time, compared to what's going on outside of class, 1 to 3 hours of time. It's usually sort of the ratio of what's going on. Now, usually, as you're doing any sort of teaching and learning, you spend hours and hours structuring what's going on inside of class. So here's all the things we're doing, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour. Here's all our activities for the day. But then the out-of-class time, you say, well, read the next week's readings. I'll see you on Tuesday. What should the students focus on? What are the important points of the readings? How do the readings connect back to what I'm talking about in class? All of these things that we just expect to magically happen, we don't involve ourselves in. And this is particularly important when we're dealing with things like Second Life and e-learning. Because if you look at the iceberg, in fact, actually the water goes right up above the top. So there virtually is no in-class at all, or very, very little. There might be a little online chat, which could be counted as in class. But everything is going on outside, which means you have to think about structuring what's going on outside. Those of you that might have taught an e-learning course, one of the most horrifying experiences you could have is an unstructured, confusing e-learning experience. It will turn you off forever. And not only that, you'll probably join the camp of let's take e-learning out of the curriculums forever and ever and ever and ever. It's funny that bad face-to-face experiences, we don't quite have that kind of reaction. So context is a change agent. The context you have can change the teaching and learning that's going on inside your courses, inside your interaction with your students. You're teaching in Second Life. You're using an e-learning approach. You're using small group discussion. You're doing all sorts of different things. At any time you alter any point of that circle, you have to revisit and think back to what is the point? Why are we here? What do I want the students to learn? Learning isn't designed in a vacuum. Where you learn impacts how you learn. Spaces can bring people together or tear them apart. And this was alluded to earlier, but I tried this, you know, wonderful Second Life thing with my class, and it pretty much, you know, got me to a point where I was now at war with my department, which is, you know, not what we would ever want for a teaching and learning experience. Changing spaces changes practice. You start involving these different types of contexts, you really got to rethink about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and what is the rationale for it. So whether we're designing learning for here, for here, for here, for here, an active learning environment where we have small group collaborative learning going on in the class. This is one of the new things in face-to-face education. We're talking about new things in e-learning. Whether you're designing learning for here, online learning environments. These are, WebCT is a good example. Or here, the Redwood Forest, where you're going out to explore and do some sort of experiment. The waterfalls, where you're going to meet your study group that afternoon. Or an island. Ultimately, at the end of all of this, the really important thing is them. The important thing is thinking about your students and what, at the end of the day, are the students getting out of this? What are the learning outcomes? What do you want the students to learn? And have you been successful? So, questions? Any questions for myself or Simon? We have about 10 minutes. Yeah?
You focus mostly, you're saying, on the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. But in terms of teaching our peers, you know, your Gen X and above, are there any differences or any things you would shift in terms of emphasis for those people? You're teaching peers, teaching people, you know, the same age. So teaching people, especially I'm thinking, teaching people who have knowledge in a particular area, you know, he's got a PhD, I've got a PhD. Teaching you in a different area, your practice.
Well, I mean, the one thing is the dazzling of technology is not quite as important. That's clearly one thing. In fact, actually, it might work against you. Trying to get a bunch of sort of traditional Gen Xers into using Second Life is a little bit more difficult than trying to get a bunch of millennial students into it. It's not to say that it can't be done. It's just you really have to make sure you're very, very careful with the rationale. One of the key things they talk about Gen Xers is being very suspicious of authority. It's almost the reverse of the millennials, who tend to trust authority more. Mm-hmm. And Gen Xers tend to be much more along the lines of suspicious of what the authority is giving them or providing them. So one of the things is trying to make all of your decisions explicit. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are we meeting this way? Why are we doing this strategy? Why are we doing that strategy? It's better for actually any type of learning. The more you can actually be explicit in your thinking about why you're creating the learning opportunities, the easier it's going to be for the learners to sympathize with maybe why something might go wrong, or not only that, but to empathize with you that, yes, you know, this is a process where we're all learning. You know, I'm not the expert in everything. And the idea is that I want you to be part of the process, and the whole thing is more of a partnership than it is me being the teacher and you being the student. So I think a lot of the key themes are there, but I think the biggest issue is probably going to be with the ubiquity of the technology and forcing some people down routes that they just are not comfortable with, or strategies.
I just have a comment. Mm-hmm. As a lifelong learner who has used the technologies available from 1959 to the present, as I am still continuing to go to school, I'm much more comfortable with the variety of technologies. And as a nursing professor, we have, at least in the States, we have multi-generational groups that we're teaching. And I think that actually the younger are more resistant than the older nurses. And so when I'm preparing my program, it's, and trying to integrate not knowing about sacrifice today. Those issues, it poses a great problem because I have people saying, I am spending a lot of money for this course, and I want it the way I learned best. And the challenge, I think, as a faculty member is to find some, because you might not have a real good team, especially when it's very intergenerational, to address those issues. And then if you go out to informal learning programs, say in the community, you're having such a diverse group. You'll have people that say, well, in my day we sharpened the needles ourselves and got blood out with hydrogen peroxide. And today it's the personal responsibility model of patient education. So it's a very difficult model to follow. And I don't know if in Canada you have nurse practitioners and specialists. So we're someplace in between.
And I think you probably have made the important leap, which is you've actually listened to and paid attention to who your audience and who your learners are. And that is the most important thing. You know, not trying to pigeonhole them into one group or another, but actually looking and saying, well, who is in my class? And what are their backgrounds? What are their biases? What are their stereotypes coming in? You know, how did they grow up? You know, what is their mental health at the time as well? All these sort of things have huge impacts. And, you know, as with any of these generational, you know, stereotypes, they're stereotypes. You know, like, they're not applicable in every situation. They just give you a bit of a guide. But you're right. And some of it is even location. You know, like, in one part of the U.S., it might be like this. Another part, it might be like that. And it's less to do with the generation than to do with your socioeconomic status, per se, or something along those lines. But I think as long as you know, as long as you made the effort to look, I think that's the key. Yeah?
You both comment on kind of something I observed, which is, I would say, learner fatigue. I think it relates to this busyness of this generation. This sort of, they really have been exhausting high school students. They jumped into college, and they're more fatigued. And I wonder whether the technology approach isn't just to facilitate learning, but to provide alternative pose or something to work the generation that's kind of hyper-stimulated, you know, hyper-scheduled, and is still sort of double-tasking, and technology fits some unique niches for them, not just some educational pedagogical standpoint, but a kind of lifestyle or life course development that's sort of filling some need that maybe people didn't have when they, high school was prom and yearbook, and they sort of gradually, and then college sort of got harder, and you know, they're more willing to sort of use the traditional sort of pedagogical approaches.
I think it's about having fun.
Everybody always assumes, you know, it's like that learning has to be painful. And although painful, it's not that learning can't be painful, but that it doesn't always have to be painful.
This generation has not been children. I mean, this is the thing that's fascinating. They've been adults and they're children. Now they're getting to adulthood and they almost need to be children again because they've really never been a child.
You're right. And for me, education is fun. And it's really, really important to make it fun. But to make the point that learning is important, it's fun. You know, get involved and it'll be valuable to you. I think communicating that as educators, you certainly did in your talk, the passion is coming through. And I think they'll pick up on that. And in these virtual worlds and in other, you know, really, really interesting platforms, it's not just from the platform, but it's what you do with it in relation to the students. So if you can value them in the context of the learning, for me, that's important. That's the end.
It's like education as performance art.
Wow. I hadn't thought of it like that, but it's a nice way to conceptualize it. There's additional learning. Yeah.
I just want to clarify, we're not using the Second Life in front of health. It's Moodle, is what it's called. And it's somewhat like FDT. We use FDT and then let's source Moodle. And so mine is augmenting my regular course where they have an hour and a half of my course time allocated to being on Moodle and doing activities as well. But that's where I'm learning extra lives. I'm the only one. So I'm kind of, and I get a little old, maybe the only one, and it's like, wham, 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 and I mean, evaluations this year have never been as horrendous. I mean, I've been for 30 years, so.
I mean, Moodle is one of the virtual learning environments that utilizes primarily two-dimensional, so text-based kind of stuff, streams in some video. Yeah, and it's open source, isn't it, as well? Moodle?
Yeah.
Moodle. Yeah, it's open source, which means you can play around the code and do really nice stuff.
Yeah.
And some of that really nice stuff in relation to Second Life is a project called Sloodle, S-L, Sloodle. Dan Livingston at the University of Paisley has done what he calls a mashup. What a lot of people do is take one application, another application, mash them together. And in Second Life, he's got a heads-up display where you can use your avatar to give non-verbal communication when you're teaching. It just makes the whole process that much more smoother. And they'll put stuff on Moodle, which can be brought into Second Life, Second Life into Moodle. So bringing the 2D and 3D web for learning and teaching together is happening at the moment. And that's where the exciting stuff is being innovated.
Well, it also goes back to that, you know, the students are also, you know, especially if you're teaching at university, they're relearning how to learn. And a lot of situations they've been in, you know, their concept of a classroom is I sit down and I open my computer and I surf Facebook and listen to you in the background. And if that's their concept and that's their experience, then anything you do that's outside of that is going to jar them. And the real question is, you know, can you jar them in a way that gets to a positive experience and gets them that, you know, excitement, gets them engaged without sort of having them fall back into some types of or styles that they've had, which are very passive.
Well, the 33% that I allocate to staff for that particular activity is not to jar them. I thought it was a windfall. 33% out of the mark was just like, bonus. You know, get in there and do a good job and you got 33%. Whatever.
Just keep going back to what do you want them to learn? What are they learning?
And oh, actually, sorry, to qualify that standard, the dialogue which has been created by this is rich, by far much more richer than I would get in a classroom. And that was my objective, because I would have 5 or 6 people dialogue in class about good activities. This, they have to all, it's the marks, and the dialogue is the depth of the breath. And what they're bringing into it, the expectation is going to begin outside of resources. And their life experience, for example, it is just rich. So I don't want to say that it's not good. It's just my experience has been like, I survived another year.
The innovators always have the arrows in their back. So just be aware that as you go forward, you got to have a thick skin and you know, make sure you're going to keep pushing. If you believe in where you're going to go, then go forward. Yeah. Any other questions at all? Yes.
You put it a couple times to kind of resistance. Like, right, I'm kind of resistant. I'm just kind of curious, you know, for educators, what kinds of resistance are you getting from the educational establishment to sort of novel ideas of technology in and outside the classroom?
The technology, it's interesting in terms of the technology. We implemented our learning management system at McGill in about 2000. So we've had it for a long time, and it's been sort of a slow swell. And there was one point where the provost said, okay, every space on campus, every class on campus is going to have a space. Even if you don't want to use it, it's all going to be there. And there's a certain point in the growth where we just sort of made it over the hump. And after we made it over the hump with a number of courses, a number of people, the students just drove it all forward. So then what ended up happening was the students would tell a faculty member, so 3 of my other classes have a space in WebCT where we can do some discussion. When are you going to put yours up? And so that is what moved everybody forward once we got over that hump. But you're right, resistance is everywhere, and you do need your senior administration behind you. Having them against you is never going to help. You definitely need them behind you.
These are long-term investments. Stuff like this, e-learning in the virtual world especially, isn't done overnight. It's not done over one term or one semester. It's a very long-term project. And it's that process of learning what does work and what doesn't work. It's a development project. And often, I have found, universities are 100% behind you in the initial phases where it's, you know, wow, look what we can do. This is great. And then, you know, that month passes, and then it's just you left doing it. And you've got 6 months to do it. And then all of that momentum disappears. And then it's often 1 or 2 innovators in the department or faculty are left to do it. And everyone else, you know, that's kind of died down. So maintaining that wow factor requires, you know, frequent maintenance of new and bright, sparkly things to show to people, to get their attention, to get them back on site. We need these ports open on our servers. We need these high-spec computers in this room by Monday. You know, this getting stuff to work requires sustained effort over a long period of time. I think in the initial stages, there's a lot of support. But then after that, the support really drops off when the bright, sparkly stuff disappears and the hard work has to be done. But my experience is it's really, really hard work to do this stuff, but it's worth it in the end. If you get to a point where your students, as you were saying, benefit from it.
Great. Thank you.